One week after George Floyd was killed in police custody, protests have spread. Curfews locked down Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. Peaceful protests turned violent in Boston. We have the latest on WCAI's Morning Edition. Residents across the Cape and the South Coast held peaceful rallies as well this weekend. And the president said George Floyd's death is, quote, a grave tragedy. So why is his tone so much more combative when he posts messages on Twitter? Also, how do you attend a protest while also maintaining social distance? Some healthcare experts worry the protests will cause an uptick in coronavirus cases. It's Monday, June 1st, 2020. I'm Catherine Ident in Barnstable. And the governor offers early guidance on how restaurants in Massachusetts may reopen, possibly later this month. It's 7:01. First, this news.
PR.
And this is NPR on WCAI. It's 7:04. Good morning. I'm Catherine Ident in Barnstable with some local news. Hundreds of peaceful protesters gathered on Falmouth's Village Green for a silent community vigil yesterday. Organizers from the group No Place for Hate say the goal was to confront racism and to honor the memory of George Floyd, who died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for at least 7 minutes. Taylor Baker of Falmouth said she was demonstrating because violence against people of color, wherever it happens, affects her.
I want this country to get better. I want this town to recognize that the policing system has to get better everywhere, not just in Minnesota or Ferguson or D.C.
Hyannis in Provincetown also had demonstrations. Nantucket is scheduling a drive-in demonstration for later today. Meanwhile, in New Bedford, protesters shut down traffic at the Fairhaven Bridge yesterday evening. It was the second day in a row protesters rallied in that South Coast city. The Standard Times reports Saturday's downtown rally started with about 20 people, but a crowd grew to about 100 by the evening. They carried signs reading, "I can't breathe," and "No justice, no peace." Police Chief Joseph Cordero says the protesters were peaceful. He also said he supports their protesters' rights, saying he was also surprised by their civility. Let's take a look at the latest numbers of COVID-19.
And from WCAI in Woods Hole, I'm John Basile. One result of the recent demonstrations over the death of George Floyd may be a new look at school curriculum. At the Barnstable School Committee meeting Wednesday, committee member Joe Nystrom said recent events have caused him to educate himself about race in America.
Right now, seven states require black history for a diploma. And I'm suggesting to this committee that we revisit Mass Core, we revisit our requirements, and we ask ourselves, what is it that we want all of our students to learn? And I believe we should make black history a requirement.
Superintendent of Schools Meg Mayo Brown said the time is right to talk to students about race in a meaningful way. Leaders of the Fall River Diocese are calling for sympathy for the black community following the death of George Floyd. Bishop Edgar DeCuna released a statement yesterday saying the faith community can no longer turn a blind eye to racism. It was not enough to be non-racist, he said, but, quote, we need to be actively anti-racist. He said it was also imperative to try to understand the experience of others, especially those who have been historically disenfranchised. Two people are under arrest and one more.
Tell me what inspired you to get out there and to talk in public about these issues.
So having people on social media is only seeing the negative side of the things that are going on in the world. I wanted to have a positive side, and I wanted to organize with my group. I wanted to make sure that there are peaceful protests out there, and I wanted to actually show people that it doesn't always have to be violent. I had the chief, and we all had a few other officers to be on our side, taking a knee with us, supporting us, walking around. Yes, there is police brutality. I'm not lying about that when I say that there is some, but these cops that I met, I truly knew in their heart that they were good cops and that they wanted to show that, and they were supporting us the entire time, and they were being there as people with us. And
we see change as a result of protests like yours.
Honestly, I just hope that the government, everyone sees that there is a problem, and instead of being silent about it, I really just want us to be heard and understood, and I want a change in the world. I don't want this to just, all die down and then just, continue on our regular life.
Jocelyn, thanks so much for talking with me. Stay safe.
Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junkers. It's Friday, June 12th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top. Rallies, marches, and protests continued this week, recognizing the death of George Floyd at the hands of police and demanding racial justice and reforms. WCAI's Eve Zukoff has been reporting from these events, and she joins us now to talk about how this week was different. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, you covered a protest in Woods Hole on Wednesday that was organized by scientists.
Yeah, so this is actually part of a national day of protests for scientists and academics to, as they say, you know, take a pause, shut down their labs, and actually reflect on racism in science, engineering, academia. Scientists at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution picked up that mantle, but more than 300 people, many of whom scientists, but many of whom not, all came out to march.
How else has the messaging in these protests evolved? Now, you've been to a number of them over the last couple of weeks.
First, I should say a lot has stayed the same. You know, George Floyd is very much present, if you will, at these rallies, but there's greater demand now, I think, for political action. In Hyannis, that was the main message, really go vote. One organizer said, you know, people asked her why she was still protesting because the officers in Floyd's case have been charged. And she was like, no, wait a minute, we're fighting to change laws. So there are just deeper and longer lasting political and cultural demands that are really starting to shape out in these protests, even in a place like Cape Cod, where, you know, a lot of
listeners are thinking that racism isn't here. Talk about what you see.
The Cape is unique. We are 92% Caucasian. So it is hard for us at times to make that link that something that we're doing or something that we've just casually accepted, like our zoning regulations, actually perpetuate racism. And we're based on policies to keep Black people out of neighborhoods. So what we see is the socioeconomically disadvantaged. You know, people who are trying to live and work here can't afford to live here. So the prices are out of reach. You need to make basically $100,000 a year to buy a home here. That leaves out many of the year-rounders, and that definitely leaves out the average median income for a Black or brown family in our country. We have an opportunity to do things differently and to be more hospitable and to be more inclusive. It's also for all of us to build a Cape Cod that represents our values and who we are.
What could people start to think about in terms of changing zoning that it might be more inclusive?
Can we find ways in the appropriate areas to allow 2, 3, 4 homes on one lot? That would mean that a buyer could pay less because the cost of construction would be less. So it's trying to look strategically and realistically at the land that we have so that working people, people of color, middle-income earners, our year-round population can live here.
It makes me think in listening to you now that it may require Cape Codders to maybe think a little differently about what they think the Cape is as far as a community and what it means to share lived space.
Yeah, and the casual acceptance, right? We inherited these zoning regulations, but the fact is they were created to keep people of color out of certain neighborhoods.
Alisa Magnota, Executive Director of the Housing Assistance Corporation in Hyannis, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Our mission at WCAI is this: to enrich people's lives through programs and services that educate, inspire, and entertain, fostering citizenship and culture, the joy of learning, and the power of diverse perspectives. The fact is, like many American newsrooms, our staff is mostly white. Of 9 journalists, we have 1 journalist of color on staff. We've made efforts to bring diversity training to the newsroom to hire and retain people of color and to actively search out the stories of marginalized members of our community. We recognize that we need to do more. As a majority white newsroom, the WCAI news staff is learning to recognize our privileged position in society and acknowledge that we don't experience the world in the same way Indigenous and other people of color in our community do. These facts will continue to guide us as we make decisions about the news we cover and the stories we tell. We've made mistakes along the way, and we'll likely make more in the future. Our goal is to be open to criticism, learn, and do better in the future. We want WCAI, both in the newsroom and on the airwaves, to be a place where we listen to one another and learn from one another, even if what we hear makes us uncomfortable. In the coming weeks and months on The Point, we plan to tackle some difficult topics around racism and white privilege. Today, our focus is the Black Lives Matter protests. Throughout our country, in fact, around the globe, people of all colors, ages, and nationalities are standing together to say no more. Are the protests the start of meaningful and fundamental change? Or have we been down this road before, a road that aims to bring about change, but instead roots us back to the status quo? In a few minutes, we'll talk with an historian and activist, but first we hear the voices and stories of people of color living on the Cape and Islands. Racial injustice, institutionalized racism, and white privilege are part of our country's history and very much present in our society today. Even here on the Cape and Islands, people of color experience racism and live in a society and region created and developed by white people for white people.
My name is Carl Lopes, and I live in Marston's Mills. I am a Cape Cod artist and a retired visual arts director of Barnstable High School in Hyannis. Being a Cape Cod person of color, Cape Verdean, and interacting both professionally and socially with thousands of youth and families, I found a majority of us citizens to be fair and open-minded regarding inclusiveness and equity. But there is a definite undercurrent of discrimination and non-inclusion that pervades us. Albeit subtle, it's here on Cape Cod. Racism has been a lifetime experience for me. There have been moments in my life where racism was not a concern, and then moments where it was all-consuming. As a 35-year career educator, I have witnessed many instances of racism among our youth, as well as the adult population. The following are a few examples. Students of color have many times entered my classroom upset because they had just been called the N-word on their way to class. My classroom was many times used as a safe room where a student could recompose after experiencing a racial incident. On the last day of school one year, a student told me that in the beginning, he didn't think he would learn anything from me because I was black. But he was really surprised how much he did learn. Nonetheless, it was a racially biased and backhanded compliment.
My name is David Vandehoop. I'm an Aquinnah Wampanoag who grew up on Nompi. First, I would like to start with an acknowledgement of the Wampanoag people, past and present, and our territory. Wampanoag people have been supporting the black community here on the island since the times of slavery. As a matter of fact, the house I live in, my grandfather and grandmother's house, was part of the Underground Railroad that led enslaved people to freedom. It is important that people of color stand together during this time because we understand and share a very similar history of oppression, and we can see things that white people, at least up till now, don't. What I would like to say to non-Indigenous people in our community is this. I am an ancestor that is part of the 5% that remain. 95% of our people were destroyed. Nobody has ever apologized or made amends from the government. Instead, our Native struggle continues every day over access to basic needs like clean water, the right to live, health care, work. It's time that things change for our black sisters and brothers, people of color, and for all Indigenous people of the world.
We thank all who shared their stories. We also thank those who responded to our request to participate in the program, but let us know they were too tired of telling white people about their experiences with racism. And we thank one person who took the time to explain why they felt our request to participate was insensitive and potentially traumatic for people of color.
I asked Silliman what prompted her to sign on as a letter writer along with six other authors. She told me she's realized she has a lot to learn about race as a white woman about to enter college.
I personally feel like I have had teachers that have taken the extra step to try to teach us about events of racism in the country and in our country's history, but it's not an across the curriculum requirement. And there's so much that I'm still learning that I wish it could be something that we were learning in school.
Sandwich High School graduate Claire Mulroy agrees. She says once she got to college, she started thinking more deeply about what she'd missed in her high school classes.
I was seeing a lot of Black Lives Matter awareness increase on social media. And for my community at school, it's a lot more politically active, I think, in terms of social justice than it is in Sandwich. And Sandwich being such a white town, I mean, it's literally 97% white. I acknowledge that I am white. And I was trying to figure out a way that I could create this change in my community, or at least start it, because I was reflecting on.
Both women agree that their former school districts need to also help students understand how racism isn't just limited to acts of hatred and that racism is systemic.
We need to be able to have uncomfortable conversations. This type of thing has never been a part of our education, and I think that a lot of people are just ignorant to, like, maybe if you make that comment or maybe if you treat this student a certain way, it could have an effect that has to do with something that you're not even clear about.
That's Silliman again. She says Mulroy and Silliman acknowledge some of their requests will take time. Both women have meetings planned with school officials in the coming days, but I asked them, what happens in the fall when their college courses start up? Here's Silliman.
I'm willing to put in as many hours as I need to get some of the legwork done this summer. And I'm also going to look for students, especially students of color at Sanders, that are able to advocate for this in the future. But I think, I don't know if I would.
Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Today we're going to talk about whiteness, white privilege, and white supremacy. And this is just one of several conversations we have been having and will continue to have about racism. Among the calls for change have been calls for white people to stand up and take responsibility for not only benefiting from, but helping to sustain a system that perpetuates racism. Talking about race, especially whiteness, is hard. White as a race can be hard for some people to even see. But many diversity trainers and anti-racist activists say that understanding whiteness and white privilege is critical in dismantling racist systems. Joining us this morning to help talk about this is Debbie Irving. She's author of Waking Up White and Finding the Story of Race. She's also a racial justice educator. Good morning, Debbie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Katie.
I want to talk a little bit about you and your story because it will help us to understand some of these really tough concepts. You grew up in Massachusetts.
Right. I mean, I think in some ways, I had a Norman Rockwell childhood. I remember looking at those images and thinking, wow, I mean, that looks just like my life. You know, how lucky for me that what I was being told was all American really did look just like my life. And it allowed me to really soak in what I now understand is whiteness, meaning white attitudes, white beliefs, not just, you know, what people look like, but all of the cultural norms that are a part of whiteness.
The importance of listening when we can and trying not to judge as white people listening to stories that if we think we're good people and we don't necessarily want to confront that maybe we have bias and racist thoughts can be very uncomfortable.
Can be very uncomfortable. And I think, you know, if I had been listening to this 12 years ago before I started waking up, because I had been taught that Black, Indigenous, and any person of color wasn't trustworthy. I mean, I didn't know I'd been taught that, but deep in my subconsciousness, that lurked there. I would have heard that story, and my first thought would have been to question it.
Right, instead of just listening, yeah. We have another caller that I want to get to. We just have a few minutes left. Sam, there are several groups around the region working on lists of Black-owned businesses for people to support. Let's start first on the South Coast. The list of Black-owned businesses in New Bedford is already approaching nearly 100.
Yeah, I spoke with Justina Perry, who started the page Buy Black New Bedford. Perry's Black herself. She's a physical therapist, actually furloughed during the pandemic. When George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police, she wanted to get involved, like many people, but she had recently given birth and was kind of afraid that if she attended a rally, she might bring the virus home to her newborn. So instead, she started Buy Black New Bedford. She says it's her way of helping to close the racial wealth gap.
There's also a similar list of Black-owned businesses being compiled on the Cape, right?
Yeah, this is also a pretty big list, close to 200 shops and other Black-owned businesses. I spoke with Tara Vargas Wallace, who is still putting it together. Wallace worked with the Chamber and other
community members. The first time Joe Lima came to Provincetown years ago, he remembers feeling like he'd arrived in another world.
You don't even feel as though you're still on the Cape. You almost don't feel like you're still on this planet.
Now Lima is the president of PFLAG Cape Cod, an organization that supports members of the LGBTQ community and their families. And even though he's been this year, many of the spaces where Lima used to go with his husband are closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Also canceled are all the festivities and events that recognize the progress made by the LGBTQ community. And in that space where there was celebration, there's been an opportunity to reflect.
It's kind of allowed us to maybe slow down a little bit and just kind of shift our our attention to other areas that need attention, such as the Black Lives Matter movement or, you know, racial injustice and equality.
In May, more than 100 people in Provincetown took part in a Black Lives Matter protest. At a vigil on McMillan Pier, speakers read off the names of Black men and women killed by police officers. For many, it raised questions about how the LGBTQ community can better support its Black and Brown members.
This conversation is coming at such an important and yet challenging time.
That's Ja D. Williams, executive director of Provincetown's Women of Color Weekend. Women with an X, instead of an E, to include those who don't strictly identify as women. She says the conversation about intersectionality is shifting in the LGBTQ community and in Provincetown. On a recent weekend trip, Williams said she noticed how many shops and venues in town had signs in support of Black Lives Matter.
A question that I feel like everybody should be asking is, how is this sustained? How does this become ingrained and entrenched?
She doesn't have the answer, but says this is where Provincetown could gain something from the pandemic. Inclusivity starts with a moment of pause, and then comes action. For WCAI, I'm Eve Zuckoff.
This is NPR News.
And from WCAI in Woods Hole, I'm John Basile. The COVID-19 infection rate among Black people on Cape Cod is three times the rate among white people. The data comes from the New York Times, which published a national county-by-county breakdown Sunday after suing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for access to the information. State Senator Julian Sear highlighted the disparity today as part of a weekly press briefing by the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force.
When we see a health disparity that is this stark, even though the data is preliminary, it's hard to deny its significance.
Sear says inadequate health coverage and access to primary care contribute to the problem. Other factors, he said, include overcrowding in housing that lower-income people can afford and over-representation of people of color among essential workers. UMass Dartmouth.
First, I just wanted to ask, what was your personal reaction to hearing about the death of George Floyd?
You know, the images that we all saw leading to George Floyd's death completely shocked and angered me. And I, like many of your listeners, watched the video over and over, and I was just really angered by it, being a police officer, that nobody intervened, nothing was done to stop it. I spoke with our officers, residents, and I answered a lot of emails about, you know, what are we as a police department doing? So we felt as a department that it was really important for us to put a message.
Let's talk a little bit about what the department is doing. You mentioned in that Facebook.
We're trying to learn what the perspective of each of the involved parties is and what could be done better to build that situation into a better place. You know, it's further done through a lot of discussions. And the police officers have to use the tools that they've learned to de-escalate situations, to make sure that bias-free policing is being used and that everybody's rights are being protected. I listened to a video from a pastor named Andy Stanley from North Point Church just outside of Atlanta. He began by asking, how do people who don't look like us experience us? And then he said, how should people who don't look like us experience us? And he went on to explain that being non-racist isn't good enough. What we need to be is anti-racist. And he equated it to anti-bullying, anti-child.
Police Chief Peter Wack, thank you so much for talking with us.
Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. We're joined at the start by WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. The role of police in our communities has been part of a wider discussion these past weeks after the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. Last night in Falmouth, the group No Place for Hate hosted a public forum on policing in the town. Jeanette, you covered this. What was the goal here and who was involved?
Yeah, so the goal was to answer any questions that people might have in the community about the practices of the police department, which, of course, is in light of everything that's going on nationally, and to create kind of a sense of transparency in the community about how the Falmouth police operate. Police Chief Edward Dunn became kind of the focus of the panel, in a sense, because most of the questions were directed to him.
Joining us again on the program is Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., Executive Director of the Privilege Institute and founder of the White Privilege Conference.
He's also the founder of the 21-Day Racial Equity Habit Building Challenge, which we're going to take a closer look at in this next hour. Dr. Moore, welcome back to The Point, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Catherine, I appreciate you giving me another opportunity.
I wanted to look at the title, and that is that you use the word equity instead of equality. Is there a reason behind that? Can you explain that a little bit?
Equity is harder. It takes work. And I'm a believer that people don't need the same thing. People need what they need. And in order for that to happen, there has to be an understanding of equity as opposed to equality. And so that's why we went, you know, what was coming to me in reference to that title, because equity presents, again, that this is calculus, not addition and subtraction.
And that's an interesting way to put it. I was sitting in on a webinar recently where this very idea came up, and the presenter was trying to present the difference between equity and equality and used bikes, saying if you were to hand a bike to a group of varying people of different sizes, abilities, and ages, one bike will not fit all. That might be equality, but that's not equity. Those people,
that's right.
Not
that's
everyone
right.
can
that's
use
right. that. And I think the same is true in reference to classrooms, in reference to resources, access to jobs. I mean, I think the same is true as we look at some of the challenges we're facing as a nation. It's the lens of equity opposed to the lens of equality that I'm suggesting and working with folks around.
And it is an example, too, of there's, I think, a lot more defining of words.
We're elevating racial and ethnic diversity, and I'd say linguistic diversity of our teachers. But I'm one who also believes that just identity matters. Like, our kids come with identities, and I think that they're looking for people, again, windows and mirrors, you know, that both reflect them. And
Takara, you talked a little bit about some of the points that Ventura mentioned as well, using your own personal experience in the classroom to be, as he said, those doors and mirrors for students. But do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think I want to include the importance of context. And I appreciate this question, because when we talk about diversity, yes, we can think about our race, our ethnic, our linguistic backgrounds, our immigrant status, our sexual orientation, and check all the boxes. But I also think context is important. When we talk about diversity in the context of our educator workforce, we are really talking about the racial and ethnic diversity gap that exists amongst darker-skinned Black Latinx educators, right, and white educators, looking at diversity through the lens of the populations that we serve and the extent to which our student population, right, 40% of whom identify as people of color, many of whom identify as biracial, many of whom who have a second language, and then seeing that difference between our teacher population is, I think, what's important when we talk about policy.
That's right. And we will talk a little more about some of the concrete ways that can actually happen and go beyond the conversation.
Our country is a mix of races, ethnicities, religions, and cultures. Yet most books published in the U.S. for children and young adults feature white protagonists. Why don't our books reflect the reality of our nation? Why is it important that children see themselves in books they read? And what can we do to encourage more diversity in the books reaching our children's bookshelves? With us this hour to talk about the importance. Jennifer, as a young reader, did you notice that there weren't many characters in books like you?
I was fortunate to be raised by a Native American teacher. My mom was the first person in her family to go to college and came back and taught in her home community. So our home was filled with children's literature, lots of Native arts and authors. And I wanted to add on to something that Mary said that I think is really fascinating to think about in terms of the mirrors and windows concept. For Native kids, a lot of times what we're teaching them in our classrooms is not just about their own culture, so about their Wampanoag community in Mashpee, but about their sister tribes in the Wampanoag Nation and their sister tribes in the Algonquian language family. So we've actually translated a whole series of Ojibwe language children's books into Wampanoag, and we were able to license the art from Ojibwe artists. And the reason that we do that is because there are almost 700 Native American tribes in the U.S., and all of those communities have such unique origin stories and family stories, and they may be completely different than Wampanoag or Lakota or Ojibwe or Cherokee, for example. Right. So those are windows for children from Native communities into other Indigenous cultures, because our...
We are talking about the importance of diversity in children's books this hour. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866...